This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
It just seems that there's always been, I guess, providence at work. As a pastor's son, I like to believe that.
Ben Utech's story is a story of faith, but since he was a football player, it's also a story about football. The football part of it begins when he was just a kid, throwing the ball in the backyard with his father.
In a little Minnesota Scandinavian town called Lindstrom.
Utech says those days in the backyard in Minnesota shaped his life and inspired his love of football, but he doesn't really remember them.
It's a difficult thing to explain, you know, to sit across from family and friends and hear stories and memories. And at times, everybody at the table remembers an event. And yet I kind of sit there in my own quietness, kind of scratching my head, thinking, why can't I remember that?
Utech does remember the injuries he sustained playing football. First, there was the hip fracture that came during the second game of his senior season in high school. Then he broke his left ankle during an All-Star game the summer before college. While playing for the University of Minnesota, Utech suffered his first documented concussion, and then there was the stress fracture in his foot. Utech kept playing through that injury. And then, as his senior year in college was ending, Utech suffered the injury that took him from being a potential first-round draft pick to wondering if he'd be drafted at all.
My senior year, I had unfortunately torn my abs from the bone on both sides. It was a devastating time. I thought football was over. And a Hall of Fame coach by the name of Tony Dungy made a promise to me in front of about 700 University of Minnesota alumni. He said, you know, Ben, if for some reason you slipped through the cracks, I promise you I'll be the first person to call. And everybody clapped, and I had a big smile on my face. But it went in one ear and out the other, thinking, you know, there's 32 NFL teams. But I went undrafted, and it was embarrassing. It was difficult. So I'm sitting across the table from my agent. The free market opens for the leftover players, the free agents. 15 seconds after, the phone rings, and who do you think it was? Tony Dungy. It was Tony Dungy. You know, Tony said, Ben, we didn't think it was going to happen. We know how talented you are when you're healthy. We want you to be a Colt. We have a doctor that is the best in the country at fixing your injury, and we want to get you surgery and give you the whole first year to recover, and we'll pay you as though you're a playing rookie. And 3 years later, I'm a starting tight end on a Super Bowl championship team.
The injuries would keep coming, but it wasn't the abs or the hip or the foot that caused the most serious long-standing problems.
My very first head injury was when I was 4 or 5 years old, running around the house listening to the Superman soundtrack. And I flew headfirst into the dresser and had to get rushed to the emergency room. But, you know, looking back on football over the course of my college career and NFL career, there was a total of 5 diagnosed concussions.
The first 3 of those concussions didn't worry Utech. Neither did the countless subconcussive hits he suffered in practices as well as games. As he had with his other injuries, he put his trust in his faith that he would be healed. Though Dr. Bennett Amalu had discovered CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, in the brain of NFL Hall of Famer Mike Webster back in 2002, 2 years before Utech's NFL career began, Utech wouldn't even hear Amalu's name until after he retired from football. But when he suffered his 4th diagnosed concussion on September 30th, 2007, in a game against the Denver Broncos, there was something about that injury that made Utech start to worry.
I had ended up on the ground, and a pursuing defender jumped over me, and his cleat clipped the back of my helmet. I can only tell you this because of what I watched on film, but my head bobbed down, my body went limp. And about 10, 15, 20 seconds after, I regained consciousness, and I stand up and high-five teammates and run off to the sideline, and I have absolutely no memory of that. And so for the first time, here I'm in this film room watching this. It's almost like it never happened.
That feeling of losing the memory of an event or a moment or a conversation would become more and more familiar to Utech. And it only got worse when less than 2 years later he suffered another injury to his brain. This time, he kept a journal of his symptoms.
8-14-09. Woke up with slight headache. I tried doing more activities around the house, but experienced increased dizziness. Still feeling as if I'm in a daze. Also, still feeling impatient and having trouble concentrating. I continue to struggle with forgetting what I was going to say, like my mind just goes blank.
2 years later, Utek and his wife Karin had moved back to Minnesota. He was still feeling the cumulative effects of those concussions and subconcussive hits, and a more troubling symptom had developed. One night, Ben and Karin reconnected with some old friends they knew from college. The two couples sat in the kitchen trading stories, and eventually the other couple began recalling their wedding day.
I couldn't place myself there, and I just interrupted the conversation and said, Matt, why wasn't I able to be at your wedding? Everybody kind of laughed it off as sarcasm, and I just said, no, seriously, why was I unable to be in your wedding? I wasn't in training camp or spring camp. And his wife went up and got their photo album and brought it back, and sure enough, page after page, there I was as a groomsman and a singer in his wedding, and it doesn't matter how many times I look at it, it just is gone.
It must have been terrifying to drive home that night with your wife, realizing that you had forgotten what would seem to be such a momentous occasion.
It was, and I don't know how to explain it to you other than, I don't know if it's just the nature of an athlete, but there was still this voice inside of me that was saying, this isn't, no big deal. You're going to overcome it. You're going to beat it. I had every other injury. And so I didn't really know how to internalize it properly, I think.
You were still thinking about trying to get back on the field, right?
Yeah, I know that sounds so silly after the time we've spent together already, but I remember, being a couple seasons out and still body still feeling really good and honestly mind recovering to a place where I felt, okay, and just wanted to be back out on that field. And I had called my agent and just said, is there any chance that I could get a workout with the team?
The agent's first response was, are you sure about this? Utek said he was. That was in June of 2013. New England Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez had just been arrested for murder. Utek figured, hey, that was my position. The Patriots weren't interested, but the Seattle Seahawks were. Utek was prepared to fly to Seattle for a workout, but there were a few people he wanted to check with first.
I had a family meeting with my mom and dad and my wife and explained the situation, and my dad said something that I hope I don't ever forget, which was, Ben, if you choose to play football again, I will never watch you. To hear that from the man who first threw me a football, it really put me back in my place and made me realize, what was most important.
Utek tried for a career in music for a while. That didn't work out, in part because he couldn't remember lyrics. But despite everything, he still sees providence in all he's endured.
The concussions have really made me realize how critical my memories are, and that has made me value, the moments in my life so much more, which has given me more purpose. So I guess, like all the other injuries in my testimony had led to me becoming a better man, so has concussions.
Now Ben Utek has written a book. It's called Counting the Days While My Mind Slips Away. He's framed it as a love letter to his wife and daughters, a place where they could go to learn about him if ever he's unable to answer their questions himself or remember the people asking them.
The book came out of a letter that I wrote to my wife, Karin, and our daughters. And in that letter was the line, "You will always be my girls." And that turned into a song that was co-written by Rick Barron and Tommy Barbarella. I had no idea what I was going to do with that song until the NFL Players Association asked me to testify at a congressional Senate hearing on the long-term effects of concussion, and I told a vulnerable story.
For the first time in my life, my brain became a priority. And the reason why it became a priority is because at 29 years old, I started to have memory problems. And it took losing my mind to care about my mind.
Wouldn't you know, the music video went viral. And it, I think it's been used, viewed over a million times. And I think it's really touched families that in some way are connected to brain disorder or brain disease.
It'll be 7 years on Monday since UTEC's last concussion, 7 years since he last played in an NFL game. But still, some mornings, when his body is feeling good and his mind is feeling sharp, Ben UTEC dreams about lacing up his cleats and stepping back out onto the football field.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I get a smile on my face when I think about it, because there's nothing like being a part of a team and playing in front of a hometown crowd of 70,000 people and winning. Every time we would win in Indianapolis and be walking off the field, they would roar the U2 hit, "It's a Beautiful Day." I can still hear it in my head. That's a special memory that always makes me want to go back.
Ironically, perhaps a little cruelly, that memory, unlike many others, remains. There's lots more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Bill Littlefield.
We have a lot of issues in this country that we need to deal with. We have a lot of people that are oppressed. You know, police brutality is a huge thing that needs to be addressed.
That's San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Prior to his team's preseason game on Thursday night, Kaepernick once again declined to stand during the playing of the national anthem. His story, its antecedents, and its repercussions are up first on this week's Three Stories You Should Know. Joining me are Mina Kimes of ESPN and Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Thank you.
So, Craig, tell us more about Colin Kaepernick, about whom we've already heard a great deal this week. But go ahead. I'm sure you've got more to tell us.
Well, he has obviously driven absolutely everyone crazy, at least everyone who disagrees with him. And it's a selective disagreement, though, because as a baseball guy, I wasn't paying too close of attention to Kaepernick's protests. But then I remembered in 1972, Jackie Robinson wrote an autobiography. And in the beginning of that autobiography, he remembered his first World Series in 1947 with the Brooklyn Dodgers and how he listened to the national anthem. And then he thought back. And he said, "As I write this 20 years later, I cannot stand and sing the anthem. I cannot salute the flag. I know that I am a black man in a white world. In 1972, in 1947, at my birth in 1919, I know that I never had it made." Colin Kaepernick's not Jackie Robinson. An America in 2016 is not the same as America in 1919, 47, or 72. But it doesn't take one of Jackie Robinson's stature or experience to see and take issue with injustice and inequality, which manifestly still exists in America. However, if you're not Jackie Robinson, I guess you're just not allowed to note that. And that is the fundamental conflict I see with the way people are approaching Kaepernick. He's saying it now instead of 30, 40 years in the past. And for some reason, that bugs people.
I think it's a really valuable comparison, because so often, you know, we're able to sanitize outspoken athletes and activists once they've passed away. Another example is Muhammad Ali, you know, who just passed, and people were saying, hey, a lot of the things he was saying sounded pretty similar. And putting these two men next to each other, it shows you that history is a living document, and that things that happened in the past, while, as Craig said, it's not the same era and they don't happen in the same way, but many of the underlying issues, systemic racism, segregation, employment discrimination, they're still happening. So when we look at Jackie Robinson or Muhammad Ali, and then we look at Colin Kaepernick, I think we're able to see pretty clear parallels between the past and the present.
Well, I have no disagreement with that. I like the idea of putting what Kaepernick has said and done in context. And I really hope that more and more people will eventually move beyond talking about his personality and what he is or isn't, and they'll talk more about the circumstances to which he's trying to draw our attention, particularly in his case, police brutality against minorities.
Well, I just think there's a common thread when anything historically dealing with racism or oppression happens in this country. And that's that if it happened in the past, specifically when the complaint and the complainant is long dead, we'll acknowledge it. But if it's happening in the present, we tend not to.
Mina, your concern this week is with a former Heisman Trophy winner. What have you got going on there?
So this Tuesday, a 29-year-old man who has not played competitive baseball since high school held a showcase at the University of Southern California. Several media members, a few dozen scouts showed up. And by all accounts, he looked average. He ran a solid 60-yard dash, smacked a few dingers, but he struggled with off-speed pitches and couldn't really play defense. Later, he received an offer from the Bridgeport Bluefish, an independent league team. Now, none of this would be national news except for the man was, you guessed it, Tim Tebow. So Tim Tebow is obviously a polarizing figure, and no matter what he does, and this was no exception. In the wake of his workout, the two predictable takes rolled in. There were the haters who argued that it was a publicity stunt. You know, Deadspin pointed out that the workout reportedly accelerated his endorsement deal. And then there were his defenders who said, hey, we shouldn't criticize a guy for pursuing his dreams. So my immediate response to this is that both sides are kind of right, but neither have really landed on what bothers people about Tim Tebow. It isn't his intentions, which may be pure or they may be cynical, but rather that his success reveals to us that sports and celebrity are more intermingled than we'd like to believe, and that none of this is really a meritocracy in the traditional sense.
Oh, I agree with that completely, in that the only reason Tim Tebow got a showcase with 40-some scouts showing up was celebrity, not sports. There are probably, I'd say conservatively, 500 to 1,000 undrafted high school or college baseball players with better baseball bona fides than Tim Tebow, who would love the chance to even have one scout take a second look at him, let alone 40.
The Bridgeport Bluefish are precisely the team with which he should be associated with. This is the same team that brought in Pete Rose to manage one game. So it is all about showcase for the Bridgeport Bluefish. And I think it's probably all about showcase for Tim Tebow, because most people who get the opportunity to work out for major league scouts don't feel that they need to tell the world about that workout. They just quietly go about trying to demonstrate their skills.
What's ironic about this is it reveals not only the extent of Tebow's, I guess, dreamer-ness, but also the fact that he keeps pursuing dreams that he's not quite good at. You know, obviously baseball, he's average at best. And football, you know, he's refused to play other positions. That's something that came out, actually, when this all happened, is that the Bucks, I believe, wanted him to switch positions and would have offered him a spot. And he said, no, I'm a quarterback. And he walked away from broadcasting, which he's been really good at. So he's such a perplexing figure in that way. I don't know if we'll ever really understand what motivates Tim Tebow.
At some point, perhaps we'll stop caring about what motivates Tim Tebow. No, wait, in this celebrity culture, we'll never do that. I'm sure I'm wrong. My story this week is about former swimmer Shirley Babichoff, who I spoke with several weeks ago. She won one gold medal and a handful of silver medals back in 1976 at the Olympics, and the expectation had been that she would win a lot more gold at that time. She aired her suspicions back in 1976 of the East German swimmers, pointing out that they had exceptionally deep voices and their times had improved very, very quickly without them practicing all that much. Babichoff was written off as a sore loser. She was ridiculed back at home. Of course, her suspicions eventually were borne out. This week, the California Senate introduced Resolution 88, and it requests that the International Olympic Committee give swimmers who played by the rules back in 76 the medals that they would have won if they hadn't been competing against people who should have been disqualified. Babichoff would like to have those medals. It still matters to her. I know that. She told me. So I hope Resolution 88 prevails. But I also hope that this story acquaints or reacquaints people with what was done to the women swimming for East Germany those many years ago. Some of them had no idea what the coaches and trainers were injecting them with. And some of them suffered very, very grim side effects. I hope that becomes part of the story. Mina, what do you think? Can the retroactive awarding of medals right this sort of particular wrong?
You know, it's great and it needs to happen, but nothing compares to being honored in the moment, right? And you hear a story like this, and you understand why people were so frustrated with the IOC this summer for picking and choosing with regards to the Russian athletes. Because when there's systemic abuse, if you pick and choose, it's going to keep happening again and again. And I feel like we're going to see this type of thing in the future over and over with medals retroactively taken away because the abuse isn't going away.
Coming from a baseball perspective on this, we tend to talk about this in completely the opposite way. There have often been conversations about stripping Barry Bonds of MVP awards and giving them to the next clean player that we know of. And those proposals are usually just laughed out of the room. No one thinks that's workable. No one thinks it's even necessary, including in many cases the player who we presume to have been clean. And I think part of the reason in baseball is because it is such an imperfect history that we have. It's nowhere near as documented as, say, East German swimmer abuse. But I wonder if in the Olympics we can certainly go back and know, just because the East Germans were very well documented in their cheating. But when you get into the business of undoing history, it gets a little trickier than you think. And it might make us feel good to do that, but in some ways it might also whitewash a very spotty past.
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been ESPN's Mina Kimes and NBC Sports' Craig Calcaterra. Thank you, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
James C. Norte, who goes by the initial C, grew up in Accra, the capital of Ghana, and it wasn't easy.
I have four siblings, two brothers, two sisters, and my dad, you know, walked out of our life when I was very little, and so I had to live with my mom. I live in a city in Accra, and it's a lot going on, and playing with friends, and going here and there, playing street football, and it was a lot of fun growing up, but it's also a lot of, you know, you kind of have to have a tough skin to grow up in an environment like that.
Norte, the oldest child in his family, had to fit in street football or soccer between whatever opportunities he could find to make sure everybody at home had enough to eat.
I was helping my mom bring some money home, and I was selling, you know, soft drinks and tomatoes and bread and stuff like that on the street. I had two puppies at the time, and Labadi Beach was a place where a lot of foreigners come. And I know they love puppies, so I bring my puppies over there. They'll play with them, and then I said, pay some money for playing with the puppy.
Norte says lots of the people he knew woke up each day trying to figure out where they could find another dollar or two. But he was a better soccer player than a lot of those other kids playing in the street. Norte was good enough to dream that he might play somewhere else. And fortunately for C. Norte, there has been somewhere else nearby, at least since 1999. That's when Tom Vernon, a former scout for Manchester United, started the Right to Dream Academy. Its purpose is to discover promising soccer players who are also interested in learning something about the world at large and how they might work to grow into taking responsible places in it. Would it sound too much like a fairy tale if I were to suggest that Norte was plucked from the street by the Right to Dream people when they recognized his potential as a soccer player and as a student? Yeah, it would, so I won't, and neither will Norte.
Actually, I wasn't actually selected to join. A friend of mine was selected, and I just happened to have the money for transportation to get to the Right to Dream. And he doesn't have any money, so I said, okay, I'm just going to come with you and get some second chance. But he wasn't too happy about it, because if you come with me, maybe they'll say he will miss his chance too. So we both kind of risked it, and we went. And I was really, really lucky, because at the time, they only have one goalkeeper. So they needed another goalkeeper to run the drills. And so I stayed, I trained, and I watched people go home every day until it was 16 of us. And they actually registered me as a Right to Dream player.
So, success. But making it into the program came with consequences.
It was going to be tough leaving home. It means that money is not coming home anymore. And at the time, my mom wasn't happy. But I'm going to receive education. I'm going to play the football that I love. And, you know, I'm going to be with people that are going to develop me as a person, as a footballer.
At first, leaving home didn't mean leaving Ghana. Norte moved to the academy about 90 kilometers away when he was 11. But when he was 15, leaving home got a lot more serious. Norte received a scholarship to Hotchkiss, a prep school in rural Connecticut. Culture shock doesn't begin to describe that transition.
When I first got to the Hotchkiss school, I thought I was in heaven. That place was special. From the food, people, how people talk, how people carry themselves around. I was doing the things that I was supposed to do and enjoying people and enjoying school and staying quiet.
Life might have gone on that way during Norte's first year at Hotchkiss if his mother hadn't passed away. He returned home to Ghana as quickly as he could. He assumed that that's where he would remain.
It was very difficult being home because I could just see in the faces of my siblings, like, what are they going to do now? They don't say it, but I could see it. There's no way I could leave my siblings like that. What are they going to do? How are they going to feed themselves? Who's going to take care of them? So I actually wrote a letter to Hotchkiss that I can't come back. Not now, anyways. Maybe in the future, if they will accept me to come back, then I will. But right now, I cannot. And I wrote that letter, and I showed it to my uncle, and he said, okay, I'm not going to allow you to send this letter to Hotchkiss. So he told me, you need to go back, leave your siblings for me, and I'll do my best to help them. And so I think it was because of him that I come back to Hotchkiss.
And it was because he came back to Hotchkiss and because he played soccer there that C. Norte caught the attention of the soccer coach from Marquette University, who'd actually come to a Hotchkiss game to check out another player. Are you beginning to see the part serendipity played in this young man's journey? Anyway, all he did when he got to Marquette was become the school's sixth all-time leading scorer, earn the team's Most Valuable Player award, and score a record number of game-winning goals, all of which suggests strongly that at some point he'd stopped playing goalie. Norte graduated in December 2015. The following spring, he began working with young players associated with FC Nordjylland in Denmark, a team partially owned by Tom Vernon of the Right to Dream Academy. Norte helps teenaged players learn the game and the discipline and integrity he says he acquired at Right to Dream. He's also begun his career as a pro player at Akademisk Boldklub, known at least locally as AB. There, his vocabulary in Danish has expanded.
I know simple things like, hey, how are you? And I'm good. And I know football terms like, you know, press, left, right, come on, guys, and stuff like that.
Looking back, Norte can appreciate becoming the first college graduate in his family. He says most people in Ghana leave school when they're 13 or 14.
It felt really good, and it was a good example to set for my siblings and friends at home and my community. You know, they're going to recognize that, and it's going to have an impact on them, and especially my siblings. I know it was going to have an impact with them.
In fact, it already has, at least on one younger brother.
Hey, Ben. He's always want to go to school. I think he's the smartest in the family. So he applied for only two schools, and he got into one of the better schools, universities in Ghana, and it's a business school, and that's what he likes to do. I was like, okay, well, I need to do something to help.
What C. Norte did was raise Aben's tuition money through GoFundMe.com. So that's another family member on the way to a degree. And that's only one manifestation of Norte's ongoing determination to mentor other youngsters, having learned how significant that kind of help can be, which is why he studied social welfare and justice at Marquette.
I want to organize something in Ghana, like a charity program or like a volunteer program in my community where I could get a lot of volunteers from different parts of the world to come to my community and you know, maybe do some mission work, maybe teaching, coaching, being around these kids in my community, and just talking sometimes could even change their demeanor. And that's what I got from the Right to Dream. Like, of course, I learned a lot there, but sometimes being with these volunteers from different parts of the world, hearing them talk to me and hearing their values, you know, kind of changed me. You need to have some values because you're going to be done with football at, you know, age 30-something, and there's a lot of life left to live.
There is, at that, and it's easy to imagine that no matter how well he performs as a soccer player, the best and most rewarding parts of C. Norte's life will happen after he's moved beyond the pitch. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style next week on the podcast, how the Great American Horse Race of 1976 ended up celebrating an interloper.
They had a begrudging respect for the mule sooner or later.
Tune in next week. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, meet the man perfectly suited for a half marathon. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. I am not completely suited for a half marathon.
No, this guy, you just wait till you hear about him. He's quite remarkable. It's no exaggeration to say that Colin Kaepernick of the San Francisco 49ers has gotten more attention this preseason for sitting down than any other NFL quarterback has gotten for, I don't know, passing, running, doing things of that nature. What do you make of the various responses to Mr. Kaepernick's response to the national anthem?
I think this is one of those things that makes me embarrassed to be in this profession, a citizen of this country, and still at least partway a football fan. I do not know why this had to draw the attention of Hot Take Nation out there, but apparently it did. And as you know, it's not the first time, nor will it be the last, that people have chosen to make a statement by using the what remains the most preposterous ritual in our country, which is the playing of the national anthem before sporting events. So I was sad to see what I knew was coming, which was the dispatches from Hot Take Nation.
All right, here's a preseason don't for you, Charlie. Don't lose a player to injury, especially a player so important that when he goes down, sports writers write off your season. Is that a fair description of what's happened to the Minnesota Vikings?
Yeah, Teddy Bridgewater, their brilliant young quarterback, pretty much had a hand grenade detonate in his knee. He's got a dislocated knee, a torn ACL, and quote-unquote other structural damage, which will put him out for the year. Yeah, this pretty much torpedoes the Vikings if you were planning on betting heavily on them.
Joe Paterno's first game as head coach at Penn State was on September the 17th, 1966, almost 50 years ago. The school will honor Paterno this September 17th, which will mark the first time that the school has honored the late coach since the sexual abuse scandal there about 5 years ago. You go along with this?
No. I really wish Penn State would get it through their heads that this is not the kind of thing you want to do. And as much as all our sympathy should go to the victims of what was really a horrible crime spree, I do sort of feel for the current Penn State players because they do not need to have this whole thing dropped on their heads again. Penn State should quietly honor Joe Paterno if they feel he deserves it in their hearts, but not with public ceremonies.
I have to call on Mr. NASCAR now, and my reason for doing so is a sad one. Betty Jane France died on Monday. She was the executive vice president and assistant treasurer of NASCAR and chairperson of the NASCAR Foundation, and she certainly had the NASCAR last name.
Yes, she did. She's the wife of Bill France, who invented NASCAR and raised a lot of money for George Wallace when he ran for president, and in return, Wallace gave him the land to build Talladega. She's the last link to the outlaw days, and she did pass away. And, of course, the many Frances who work for NASCAR all gathered at the funeral.
Okay, baseball story.
Hey!
Adrian Beltre of the Texas Rangers had to hit against against Pat Vendetti of the Mariners on Monday. Vendetti is the only switch pitcher in the major leagues, can throw with either arm. Beltre felt the only way to deal with the situation was to put his batting helmet on backwards, and then did Pat Vendetti put his left shoe on his right foot, and then did Beltre attempt to hold up his pants with his shoelaces, and when is this madness going to end?
This is really wonderful. Beltre went up to pretend to hit left-handed, and as part of his clever ruse, he decided to put his helmet on backwards.
We ought to tell our listeners how this at bat ended, Charlie.
Yeah, Beltre hit a double. You know,
so it is so
bad. He could have worn his helmet on his feet, apparently, for all it mattered.
Vendetti doesn't have enough tricks up his sleeve. Oh, I mean sleeves. Travis Rudolph, very talented wide receiver for Florida State University, but he has other attributes as well, like, for example, compassion. He recently visited a Florida middle school and made news for where he chose to sit in the cafeteria. Tell me about that.
Yeah, there was a boy named Bo Paskey who's somewhere on the autism spectrum, and he was sitting by himself. So Travis Rudolph went over, sat down with him, and had lunch with him. Had himself a big old slice of pizza and chatted with him, and I guess Bo's mom, you know, managed to get video of that up to the internet, which has since gone viral, and I hope put Travis Rudolph in the running for this year's Heisman Trophy.
I hope so, too. It's nice to hear a good story coming out of that venue. You want to shout sports?
No, not yet.
In a sort of preemptive?
No. It gets worse than this.
Okay.
Just bring this story.
All right. Thank you. Pokemon Go is a game, and we are only a game. So I'm going to report that some Pokemon Go players in New Zealand found a heck of a prize on a recent quest.
They busted an actual criminal.
Yeah.
They were out looking for, you know, whatever you look for in Pokemon Go, and they heard a car alarm and they saw a guy with a mask running past them in real life.
And he wasn't
and
on
not
their phones.
On the little telephone screen. And they called the cops and they brought him in.
Hey, wait a minute. That guy's real.
Well, and considering that the only stories we've heard about Pokemon Go people being oblivious to the real world have resulted in them accidentally crossing borders and disrupting Arlington National Cemetery and walking off cliffs, I think things are getting better all around.
All right. And finally, the world...
Sports!
The World Gravy Wrestling Championship was recently held in Stacksteads, Lancashire. You will be surprised, I'm sure, to learn the venue was outside a pub.
This is quite amazing. First of all, you have to wear formal dress to compete.
Of course you do.
And if you lose, which I presume is everybody but one guy, you have to take some time in the quote-unquote laughing stocks where the guys in the pub, who are sockless at this point, I'm sure, get to throw gravy at your head. And the defending champion, by the way, was a guy named Joel Hicks, whose nom de gravy is Gandalf the Gravy. I want to go to this bar so bad.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated these days. He also joins me, of course, each week on Only a Game. Thank you,
and
Charlie.
Bill, do you know how you get to the pub? On the gravy train.
I see, it's funny, Vic.
Yeah. Thanks, Bill.
Running is a solitary activity for most people, but for Mike Tozer, running has become a way for his family and his whole community to cope with what could have been a difficult diagnosis. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Mike Tozer was well into his 30s by the time he caught the running bug. Before long, he was hooked.
Something about the way I've been made, I just really love running. Every sort of 10 days, I have a day off in my training schedule, And I can be a little bit grumpy on those days when I haven't got out and run.
Mike says running brings him a lot of joy. But when he first started training along the Charles River in Boston while working on his master's degree at Harvard, Mike had no idea that running would soon help him make sense out of his family's biggest challenge. Because in those first few months of running along the Charles River, Mike didn't yet have a name for that challenge. All he knew was that something seemed to be wrong with his newborn son, Josiah. Mike's wife, Helen, has a background in early childhood development, and Mike says she first noticed the signs.
He wasn't meeting milestones, even the first few months. In fact, even when he was born, he came out with his eyes closed, and his sister was, our eyes were bright, you know, wide open. Yeah, the doctors told us to start with, or maybe he's a boy, he's going to be slower. But the more questions she started asking, the more the doctors realized that something was going on.
It took 18 months of testing for doctors to put a name to that something. Fragile X syndrome, a genetic condition that causes cognitive delays, learning difficulties, and behavioral challenges. It's the number one cause of inherited intellectual disability and the most common known single gene cause of autism.
And yet, yeah, we'd never heard of it before when he was diagnosed.
Mike had been reading about all sorts of fatal genetic conditions on the internet, and he was relieved to learn that his son would be able to live a long and happy life. Mike and Helen moved back to Hong Kong. That had always been the plan once Mike got his degree, and started a small nonprofit, a community to support families living with Fragile X. And then, as the next logical step, Mike Tozer put on a custom-made bright blue business suit and a pair of even brighter yellow sneakers and got ready to run a half marathon. Wait, what?
In some ways, it's all happened so, you know, step by step, it seems to make a lot of sense. But it's only at times like this that I step back and realize, yeah, that needs some explaining. It first started when a friend's friend that had just broken the world record for the fastest half in a suit. And at that time, it was 1 hour 35. That was the record that he set. Uh-huh. And I thought, wow, that's, you know, I've just run 1 hour 16. That's achievable for me. You know, and then probably about 2 months later, got broken again. And then that second guy, he said in one of his interviews, he mentioned that the fact that running with the suit was kind of like a cognitive dissonance. His brain was going, you're hot, you know, take off the jacket, take it off. And yet the other half of his brain was saying, you've got to keep it on the whole way. And that really made me think about Fragile X.
okay, this needs some more explaining. Running a half marathon in a business suit reminded Mike of Fragile X in two ways. First, people with Fragile X can't produce one particular protein. It's called FMRP. And that one missing protein causes problems related to brain development. For Mike, that was like the suit. Wearing the suit was just one apparently small difference from the other people running the half marathon. But the suit made the runner hot. It made it hard for him to move. It got wetter and heavier as the race went on. It caused a lot of different problems. And then there was that cognitive dissonance. Mike compares that to the social component of autism. He says his son really, really wants to engage socially. But he can't, much like the runner in the suit can't take his jacket off, no matter how overheated he gets.
That was the double seed that really sewed it in my mind.
So Mike went to a local tailor and had a special suit made. The tailor made sure he had a little extra room in the hips. All the pockets except one are fake.
They did a shorter cut, so it's just above the ankles, a bit less material. But other than that, it's a real suit. It's one, as I'm showing today, can be worn to work.
Mike sent us a picture of himself in the studio in Sydney, where the family now lives, just to prove that he really did wear the suit to work. Back in May, Mike put on his brand new bright blue suit and lined up for the start of the Sydney Morning Herald Half Marathon. Mike isn't used to getting a lot of attention when he runs. But, you know, the guy running in a business suit is going to get noticed.
Even police were kind of turning into the race and shouting, "Go, suit man!" cheering me on, and all that attention kind of went to my head and ended up going off way too fast at the start of the race.
Mike thought this burst of speed was great. Helen knew better.
And at one point she was yelling at me that I was going too fast, and I thought, I'm still quite confident at the sort of 6-7k mark that I was on for the record. But in the second half of the race, as the sun was rising, and I just felt like I was running along with this very, very heavy piece of material that was, pulling back and down on my shoulders, and I started to drop away from the runners that I was running with. My morale dropped and I felt the record slipping away from me.
Mike missed the record by 27 seconds.
It was a disappointing moment, but like with life with Fragile X, you pick yourself up quickly, and my wife said, this was such an endeavor for our family. She said, you've got one more attempt. This is it. You've got to make this work, or we're going to retire the suit.
So Mike trained harder. He got a coach. He doubled down. The whole time, Mike wasn't really sure whether Josiah knew what he was trying to do for him and other kids living with Fragile X.
He understands, I think, a lot more than he's able to say. He can say daddy running, but I think he'll get there. His sister, she's the one that gives me a lot of banter. She's only 7, but she said to me the night before, Dad, remember, go slow in the first half and then fast in the middle and then speed up when you see the finish line. That's her advice. Basically the same as an Olympic level coach, she is.
Just 11 weeks after his final attempt, Mike put on the suit again for his second and final try. This time, Mike tried to ignore all the attention and he ran and focused on what he was there to do.
There was moments when I was thinking about my son, thinking about other families I know that are affected. There was a really sad story in Sydney of a family that, a Fragile X family that were involved in a car crash where the dad just, life was just too much for him, and he ended up taking the lives of three of his family members in a car crash. And so it was a moment in the race where I was just suddenly thinking, it's just so much pressure on dads, particularly those affected by special needs. I was in a way running for them as much as I was running for myself and my son.
But soon this second race started to seem a lot like the first race. Helen was cheering him on again, and again, she wasn't happy.
She was yelling at me and looking at her watch and realizing that there was literally going to be seconds in it, and I really had to pick up the pace.
Mike did pick up the pace and entered the stadium for the final lap with about a minute to go, at least on his watch.
And I thought that I was pretty comfortable, going to cross the line. But as I rounded the final straight, I looked at the clock. I knew I had to cross the line before 13 seconds. As I crossed the line, the clock went 13 to 14. I thought, oh no, I haven't done it. Oh no, all that effort, and this is it's going to be my last attempt, and I haven't done it. And then I went over to check with the timekeeper, and he pulled up my time. He said, you did it by 3 seconds.
Mike had been looking at the wrong clock. There was a full marathon going on at the same time, and the clocks for the two races were just a few seconds off. After feeling the disappointment of thinking he hadn't set the record, Mike was now beside himself over the fact that he had.
Oh, I was just overjoyed. You know, I span around and almost knocked over the flat screen TV that was showing the results behind the timekeeper in my excitement to find my wife and give her a hug.
Mike did find Helen, and he did give her that hug. But Josiah wasn't able to be at the finish line. He wasn't able to come to the race at all. The effects of Fragile X make it difficult for Josiah to be around large crowds and commotions. So he stayed home. But Mike says Josiah is doing really well.
Yeah, he's just a really, really lovely kid with a great sense of humor. You know, as I've shown and as he shows on a daily basis, you know, even with things holding you back, you can really excel.
Mike Tozer is still waiting for Guinness to certify his world record. But while he waits, he's noticed that there's also a record for fastest marathon in a suit. That one stands at 3 hours, which Mike says just might be within his grasp. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Mina Kimes' dog, Lenny.
Lenny, trying to work here.
I think Lenny should get the last word.
You got it, Craig. Seems as if Lenny liked our recent story on Father Joe Young and his irrepressible dog, Moses. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thank you very much for listening.